And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and thank you so much for joining us here on the program. We're going to have a fun time today. We come your way Mondays, Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., as well as Mondays at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com, as well as podcasts on SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and we have Player FM and Blueberry and a bunch of others. And we certainly hope that you will make it a point to go to the guests link that is there. Look at the little grocery cart and you will be able to you'll be able to figure out more about our guest and what we're going to be talking about today. And we certainly hope that you will listen to the entire interview. There may be more on this program than meets the ear, so you're going to want to go to the podcast if you're listening to the radio broadcast, because we only get 50 minutes. And and if you like what you hear, maybe you go to the missions page. You've never listened to this. This is the first interview you've ever listened to before. We certainly hope that you will go to that link, go to the missions page, read about what we're all about, and then go down to the bottom of the page. If you like what you hear, you like what we're doing, and you'd like to support us financially, we have a PayPal and Patreon account, and we'd love for you to join us on this wonderful journey. And certainly go to our guest website, because it's going to be a lot of fun. And I think those are all of the announcements for today. We are asking you to stay with us because we have a fun program today. I think you're going to enjoy it. We are going to be talking about we're going to be talking about the laughter guide. You got it, folks. We're going to be talking about laughter, the importance thereof, with our very special guest here on the program. His name is Isaac, and I believe the last name, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. You can slap me around a little bit if you want. Preleltinsky, is that correct? Isaac, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. You get an A for pronouncing my last name correctly.
Did I mess up the first name?
you get a B plus for Isaac, but an A for Preleltinsky.
Okay, so Isaac is the name, correct?
Yes, yes.
And Preleltinsky is the last name. You are a professor. And I have to say that when I think about the work that we're going to be talking about today, because it's extremely important, we don't do enough of it in this world, I look at your picture on your webpage and I'm going, I don't think he's read his own book. But by the same token, you are a professor, so you must maintain a certain level of decorum. I do understand that. It's great to have you with us. We're going to be talking about one of the fun things that you've done, and I know that you certainly have done a lot of fun things in your life, but you've put together this wonderful series called the Laughing Guide Trilogy. And we have the Laughing Guide to Change, the Laughing Guide to a Better Life, and a Laughing Guide to Well-Being. Now, I'm going to start with, of course, the first one, the Laughing Guide to Change. One of the things that I have come to the realization, whether I've accepted it or not, I don't know. I'm still working maybe on it. And that is that there is, in reference to this concept of change, there is one constant in the, there is one thing that will never, ever, ever change in this universe in which we live. And I realize, folks, it's a paradox. But that one thing that will never change is change.
Mm-hmm.
You can't
mm-hmm.
escape it. And so you almost have to laugh at it. Now, I don't know about you, Professor, but it used to be that I would get really irritated when stuff didn't work right. Matter of fact, when I was in the early days of my career, I was acquiring audio equipment. I bought this one cassette deck. It was a top loader, and it wasn't working right. And I got so upset that I actually slammed my fist down on it. And, of course, I broke it, which was kind of silly to do, but I broke it. And yet today, if that had happened, I probably would have been sitting there laughing. Now, I don't think that's medically, due to medication. I think it's just that I look at that and I chuckle, because I think, Oh, isn't that an interesting turn of events? Okay, now I'm going to have to figure out another way to accomplish this. But I'm finding myself doing that a lot. What about you? Have you had that kind of an experience where you've sort of transitioned to ha, 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 ha. That's the way it goes, and let's just keep moving forward.
Yes, I think so. And you know, people say that the world can be funny if you look at it through funny lens. And this is what my wife and I, in the three books, what we try to do. We try to look at the challenging issues through comic lens. And then all of a sudden, what may seem an insurmountable problem becomes so much more doable, so much easier to deal with problems when you are able to, first of all, laugh at yourself with a little self-deprecating humor. And then all of a sudden, all the anger dissipates. You are able to come up with more creative solutions instead of breaking the cassette deck. So you are just more open-minded. And this is what the research finds. When we're able to laugh at things, we generate positive emotions, and positive emotions lead to more creative, intelligent solutions for daily problems. So there you have it. I am really working hard myself to laugh at all my defects and problems, and it's working. It's working.
And the laughter isn't a self-deprecating kind of laughter. It's not, oh, look at how terrible I am. And because I have met so many people, Professor, who, and I've heard them on the radio and on television and just in conversations, they're just constantly putting themselves down. But mm-hmm. when you are able to laugh at your own personality traits. I don't want to see, this is the other thing too, is, and it's not that I want to get politically correct, but at the same time, words have power. And so when we start talking about our personality failures, or as one therapist told me back in my 20s that I had character flaws, I thought, I don't have character flaws. And this is just the way that I am. You may not like some of them. I may not like some of them, but this is who I am. When we talk about failure in life as opposed to success, I think about Thomas Edison, and he was once asked how many times he failed before he came up with the working light bulb, and he says, "Well, I never failed. I just found 990 ways that it didn't work." So when we start talking about ourselves in particular and who we are, I sometimes wonder if maybe we should try to look for different words to describe that are not so self-deprecating, that we're not putting ourselves down.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think self-deprecation is a good tool, you know, if you're able to laugh at yourself, but that already reflects level of maturity and self-compassion that you can really live with it. So when I make self-deprecating jokes about my girly voice or my big ears, you know, or my funny accent, I say this from a position of strength and confidence. You know, I'm able to laugh at myself with other people, and we're all just having a good time, which is very different from people who put themselves down, who lack any sort of self-compassion, self-understanding, or, for that matter, a sense of self-worth. I agree with you completely that people often engage in such self-put-downs that is very toxic for their own well-being. And I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. My wife, who's also a psychologist, they used to run a group for women. And these were women who were struggling with the issues of depression and anxiety, and they used to say terrible things about themselves. And then when Ora, my wife, asked the women, would you be saying this about somebody else? Would you be describing other people in such terrible terms? The women were horrified. They said, oh my goodness, of course I would never, never say these horrible things about other people. And I just think that we have to embrace fairness towards ourselves. Of course, it's important to be fair to other people, but it's also hugely important to be fair to our own selves. And people who engage in these toxic self-put-downs are just not fair to themselves. It happens a lot, but there is help available for depression and anxiety. Unfortunately, we live in a society that often promotes the lack of personal worth, because we live in a culture that's always telling us, compare yourself to the next person. Perhaps your selfie is not as good as the selfie of your friend. Perhaps you are not as educated, wealthy, or sexy as other people who are glowingly touting their success on Facebook. So we live in a culture that puts a lot of pressure on people, and if you don't succeed by comparison, you often end up blaming yourself. So the culture has a lot to do with how we end up viewing ourselves.
And I would also say, too, that it's perpetuated at some of the highest levels in our country, in particular, and which is really unfortunate. And sometimes it's directed at a specific individual, and sometimes it's directed at an entire group of people, based upon whether it's their economics or their or their ethnicity or their education or their religious leanings, et cetera, et cetera, or even their sexual proclivities. You know, their identity and so forth.
Yes.
You know, and then of course there's also this other criticism too. That professor, you just want, you know, if there's a competition, you just want everybody to be winners. There are no winners and losers. We're all winners, and we're all going to get trophies. And that's not what you're talking about here.
No, absolutely not. Nobody likes to live in a culture of mediocrity. So all of us aspire, you know, to have a sense of mattering. That I matter in the world, you know, that I count, that I am somebody, that I'm important. And mattering consists of feeling valued by myself and others, what we were just talking about. I want to be respected by other people, feel valued, acknowledged. But that's only half of the equation of finding meaning in life. The other half is adding value, making a contribution to yourself, others, in the community. We don't want to live in a community where everybody is just all about feeling valued. I'm here, love me, protect me, admire me, without adding value, without exerting effort, without striving for excellence. And we need to do both. And there is competition in life. It's natural. Not everybody can be at the top of the class. Not everybody is a great swimmer or a great violinist. But I think the key here, when it comes to education, is to reward children for effort as opposed to just for accomplishment. When we reward children just for accomplishment, you know, oh, great, you're number one or number two in class. But what if you worked really hard and you're still number six or seven in your class? Then what we need to tell kids is that we really appreciate their effort.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're going to grow what is called a growth mindset. A growth mindset says, when I have a problem, if I work hard enough, I can get better. It doesn't mean that I will be the first in class. But perhaps with a growth mindset, as opposed to a fixed mindset, which says you're either smart or you're not so smart. And when kids feel that they're not so smart, they tend to give up. So the key is to reward effort, to tell kids, I really value how hard you worked on this. And eventually, the kid will find some area of life where he or she will really excel, right? Because all of us have strengths. We just need to dig deep enough and to explore with our loved ones and with ourselves, what is it that I'm really great at? And then nurture our strengths. Once we find our strengths, then we really can excel and can be the best among our peers, or can just nurture a sense of accomplishment. I'll give you an example. My son, from young age, he had some challenges with organization at school, although he was very smart. School was sometimes a bit of a challenge because of some attentional issues, but he discovered that he was very good at chess. And we always rewarded reinforced effort. And he went on to make a career out of chess. So he did a master's degree in special education, gifted education, and today he's a very successful chess coach. So at the beginning, school was a challenge, but we worked with him to find something that he was really good at. All of us have these seeds of strength and assets and excellence. So it's not advisable to educate kids just based on performance, but it's better to educate our kids based on reward. And then they will feel good about pursuing what is it that I'm great at. And we have to help kids explore different domains of their life.
Well, I tell you what, that probably would have gone a long way for me growing up in school. Not that I was terrible. I was probably an average student, you know, a C, maybe a C plus, that kind of thing. But I had challenges. And again, I say this not to make excuses. This is more of an explanation as to why. I was born legally blind and I had to wear thick glasses and I carried around big print books. But I still managed to learn something in both grade school and high school. But what it did for me was when I got out of high school, I went to junior college and I signed up for English 101, not knowing what the syllabus was. First day of class, the teacher starts going through the list of here's what we're going to do in this semester. Bah, 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 bah. And you're going to write 5 essays. And I'm thinking, I think I took the wrong class. I don't know how to write an essay. Well, by the end of the term, by the end of that semester, I had written my 5 essays and I loved it because I learned the structure. I learned what the instructor was telling us and so on and so forth. I also became very interested in grammar and making sure that I was grammatically correct, not just in my writing, but even in my speaking as best as I am able to convey my thoughts and ideas in a manner in which it will be understood by hopefully the majority. I even get criticized, and it's in fun that the criticism comes. I have two real pet peeves when it comes to grammar in broadcasting, especially. You've heard this time and time again on radio and television, I'm sure, but you never hear this when you go to speak. You are never introduced in such a way that is grammatically incorrect. But individuals who stand at the podium won't do it either. But on radio and television, they'll introduce themselves by saying, "Hi, this is Richard Dugan." Well, wait a minute. How does that work? And I hear this in commercials especially, but in other areas too. And it's like when you're in broadcasting, you're talking to one person. And, of course, the second one has to do with the phone numbers. There are no O's in phone numbers. There are zeros. Show me where the O is. Now, if the phone number translates into the letters on the keypad, that's a whole different thing, you know.
Right.
1-800-RICHARD. Okay, that's different. So those are two of them. And yet, one of the reasons that I got into this business 40 years ago was to make a difference and to raise the bar, to help to educate people. You know, how successful I've been, only God knows, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you speak, and you're originally from Argentina, and I, by the way, I have to applaud you for this, because in addition to the places that you've lived, as well as the 26 countries that you've spoken in, Israel, Canada, Australia, as well as the United States, but you also speak three different languages. English, of course, as we know, Spanish, and I think one of the things that I would love to hear about, too, as we continue our program, is about Hebrew. I know a little bit about Hebrew. I have a set of cards of the alphabet. I know that each letter has its own legend, if you will, sound and meaning and this and that and the other. And then you start putting the letters to words, and it changes all of that, words to sentences, etc. But then when we take the great wisdom teachings of the various philosophies over the centuries and we start translating them into other languages, that legend disappears unless the translator is aware of that legend and isn't just translating the letters from the one language into their language or whatever it is. And I joke with people about that, saying, if you don't believe that there's a problem with that, then just take our Constitution and the Second Amendment to the Constitution, which I've done some reading on in reference to the controversy over it. It's been going on for over 200 years because in spite of the fact that the Constitution and that amendment were written in English, we still don't know. We still are not unified on what its meaning is. So if we're having problems with English 250 years ago or 240, you know, where's the hope for understanding foreign languages that have been translated into English from 2000 or 200,000 years ago? Talk to us a little bit about that aspect, if you would.
Well, first of all, let me comment on what you said about skills, because you're talking about the structures of grammar, and that you have a particular affinity with excellence in grammar, which I really respect. And I think what you're saying is that skills, the introduction of skills, are crucial for success in life. So you have made a career in broadcasting by perfecting your language, your communication skills. And what we're doing in these books, in the trilogy, The Laughing Guide to Change, The Laughing Guide to Well-Being, and The Laughing Guide to a Better Life, is introducing skills so that people can succeed in their relationships, in the psychological domain, in their physical domain, at work, in the community, etc. So the books, going along with the idea of skill building, each book is divided into two sections. The first section is the laughing side. So I introduce a serious topic through humor. A lot of humor, funny stories, which tend to put the reader in a jovial mood, which is good for learning. And then the second half of each chapter is the learning side. So we have the laughing side and the learning side. So what I'm trying to share with you and the readers is that it's extremely important to acquire skills for excellence. None of us is born with all the skills that we need to succeed in relationships, to succeed emotionally, to succeed at work. So that's a note about skills. And now with respect to using, speaking various languages, I am particularly fond of Hebrew because each word in Hebrew has three letters which constitute the root of the word. So it's a logic game. So if you know the three letters that constitute the root of the word, then you are going to be able to extrapolate from the root and then make sense of many, many words derived from that root. So one other thing that speaking multiple languages does for you is it increases your respect for diversity. And when it comes to humor, for example, humor is very culturally contextual. I went to Japan last year to give a few talks, and I did not dare make a joke because a colleague of mine from Japan said, "Isaac, I just love your serious side of the book. For the life of me, I can't get your humor, you know, when it's translated into Japanese." But it's fun to appreciate humor in other languages. I come from Argentina, from Cordoba, where there is a very unique self-deprecating type of humor, which I really love. In Israel, there is a lot of sarcastic, cynic humor, which I also love. So by living in other countries, speaking other languages, I think I've been able to enrich my repertoire of humor and understanding other cultures. So it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
That's interesting. And these are things that we don't understand in this culture, in this society here in the West. I've done interviews with people who have written books in reference to doing business, for example, in China or in the Asian countries, which China is one. And you do not do business in China the way that you do it in the United States or even in Europe, et cetera, et cetera. You wouldn't conduct business the way you think in the Middle East, in the various countries, because they have their own culture, they have their own etiquette, you know, and so forth. And this is one of the, I think, one of the things that I am so grateful, in spite of the fact that, I'm a little cynical about the education I did receive in grade school and high school, from the standpoint that there's a lot of stuff I wish they had taught me and they didn't. But I have learned more about that, especially being in this industry, because of all of the incredible diverse people who have, I've been around people who have gotten their PhDs while I have worked and produced their programs and watched them change and develop and grow. And I glean everything that I possibly can from them. So, you know, I feel sometimes like I've gotten my PhD, even though I don't have the paperwork to prove it.
Right.
Although I am fairly proficient in Photoshop, so, you know.
Right.
I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Tell Me Your Story. We're talking with Dr. Isaac Preletensky, and he is the founder. He is the former dean of the School of Education and Human Development at the University of Miami, where he currently serves as the vice provost for institutional culture. Fascinating. We'll get into that hopefully as well. He, as has been mentioned, was born in Argentina, lived in a number of different countries, and he's also fluent in these different languages we've already mentioned. And I'm really intrigued by the work that you and you say your wife are doing. Well, let's get into that when we get back from our break. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. New paradigms for a new world. Don't you go away, because, as I've said before, class has not been dismissed.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story. New paradigms for a new world. Isaac Preletensky is my guest. Dr. Preletensky is joining us here on the program. I am going to venture the guess that you're there in Miami, or at least in Florida, as we speak. You've traveled the world. You've experienced all of these different cultures, these different protocols, etiquette, and so on and so forth. How did you prepare yourself as you went from place to place? Not so much in the places where you lived, because you had an opportunity while you lived in, say, Israel and in Canada and so forth, to learn as you lived there. But as you described in the first segment about the humor that you would use in your speeches, and some people didn't get it because, how did you educate yourself on those cultures as you began to experience the disconnect that was shared with you, so that you had less of that and people understood and got the meaning behind not only your humor, but obviously the rest of your speech as well?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think it's very important to be very humble and to know how to ask questions from the local people. So I did a speaking tour a few years back in South Africa, and there are so many subcultures in South Africa. There is really a tapestry, very rich tapestry of cultures and people from different backgrounds. So I had to ask a lot of questions from my hosts and make sure that I consulted the locals. You know, we're all experts in something. So the key is to find the experts in the local culture and just pick their brains and be very humble. Not pretend that what we have learned here, either in Canada or the U.S., transfers automatically to other parts of the world. And some of the things that we export are not really great for other people. So it's really from a position of a learner that I have gone to other places. And before you make a pronouncement with a great deal of confidence in another culture, I think it's really good first to observe, to ask questions, and to immerse yourself before you really make a fool of yourself. That's all I can say. If you go at it with the expectation that you will learn from your colleagues and the audience, then I think you are on safe ground. And this is just good advice, I think, if I may be so bold, for relationships at work, in the community, in your family, which is basically to suspend the judgment and stop pretending that we know more than we do. A position of humility, of inquiry, you know, the stance of the learner is the best position we can assume in order to foster good relationships with everyone, our loved ones, our kids, our parents, spouses, co-workers, neighbors, which is asking more questions than telling people what you think, or more importantly, what they should do in life. We should really switch the balance of how much we talk and how much we listen. I think it's a disease that we talk more than we listen. And when we listen, we have to know how to ask good questions. And good questions are usually open-ended questions. And open-ended questions are, tell me about X. What has been your experience working in Taiwan, for example? I went to give a series of talks in Taiwan. And that's the best position, when you assume you know nothing. And then you have the freedom to ask a lot of questions. That's my best advice.
Mm. Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and certainly that is one of the key elements in interviewing, as I learned early on. You don't ask. So, did you enjoy your time in Israel? Which implies that all you have to do is say yes or no. You know, what was your time like in Israel? Now, there is a question that hopefully draws some good information. I will say that I've had guests on the program who, and you know, it's intentional, and it's their opportunity to, so to speak, toot their own horn. So I'm not particularly concerned or upset about it. But I often have had guests who will They'll basically say, after a question that I've asked, they say, well, you know, Richard, I talk about that in my book on page 62. And I'm thinking, no. Talk to me from your heart, you know, not from your head so much. Share with me, you know, the personal aspect of it. I can go and read the book. My guests, can go, my listeners can go and read the book.
Right.
I want to hear in your own words, which of course the book is too, but just, you know, separate from that book. And sometimes we don't talk about the book as much because, again, people can get a copy thereof. And I want people to learn more about the guest and where that guest is from. And that's one of the reasons why I'm curious about the collaboration between you and your wife. How long have the two of you been working together in this particular area? It's just, to me, it's fascinating that a couple has the, I want to say the strength, because it's one thing to be married to someone and you go to your job, she goes to hers, and then you come home and you spend the next 8 to 12, 14, 16 hours together, and then you go off. But it's another thing to be working sometimes, maybe you're together 24/7, and you're working on this project that could, you know, hey, strain some things. So I'm curious as to how that has come about. How did that start, and how do you how did the two of you maintain that?
Well, that's a great question. I have to say that we nourish our working relationship with a lot of humor. My wife certainly didn't marry me because of my great looks. I think she enjoys our time together because we nurture each other emotionally and intellectually, and because we have fun together. And we've been married for 36 years, and we're both psychologists, so we have had this shared interest in what contributes to happiness and health and the well-being of people in our family, in the work we do with individuals, with students at the university, with people in the community, with organizations that we consult with. So although I started my career in clinical psychology, I soon discovered that I was more interested in community psychology, which is about preventing mental health problems before they happen. My wife was more interested in counseling psychology, working with individuals and groups. So we both found ourselves interested in well-being, happiness and health from different points of view that are highly complementary. So our first book together, we published in 2006, and we really take great pride in the fact that we wrote a book about well-being that nearly destroyed our marriage, but we're still together. we're very different writers. Ora is a perfectionist. She's a great psychologist. She knows all the research. I often say that she's my secret weapon. She reads everything, and she knows everything. And she's very perfectionistic. And I tend to be more content with my production. So there are certain parts of the book we published in 2006. The book is called Promoting Wellbeing, Linking Personal, Organizational, and Community Change. So we both wrote separate sections, and then we put them together, and we're still fighting over some things that she doesn't agree with me, and it has become a subject of laughter. So, and then we started this major project. We created an online intervention. It's called Fun for Wellness. People can visit it at funforwellness.com. And we did very serious research. We conducted two randomized controlled trials to see whether this intervention, which consists of mini coaching sessions, case studies, vignettes with professional actors, video games, humor. I said to Ora, would you help me write the content for this platform? And I guess I exerted enough guilt in her that she acquiesced and says, all right, I'll work with you. And Aura did a fantastic job, so we created this platform to help people improve their well-being. And then we wrote so much content. I wrote some humor, Aura wrote the great well-being sections, the coaching sessions. So we said, why don't we write some books based on this? And Aura was also, this time around, very reluctant. Oh, another book, it's a huge project. Well, I dragged her kicking and screaming, but I think the result, the outcome is really good. We have this trilogy of books. I wrote the first one, The Laughing Guide to Wellbeing, but Aura did a good job helping me, really great job helping me with The Laughing Guide to Change. She took the leadership with that book, and then she was my co-author in The Laughing Guide to a Better Life. So now we have a trilogy, and so I have to say that guilt works. I just exerted enough guilt in order that she's all right, I'll work with you, I'll help you. But our relationship grew a lot over the years. We understand each other. I think we're compassionate towards one another, and I think we complement each other very well. But any relationship requires work. And by work, I mean reflecting on our own hot buttons, on being appreciative of other people's hot buttons, avoiding them, and just trying to exercise self-reflection and learning what will help me and my relationship at the same time. It's not one or the other. In every relationship, it's hugely important to balance your well-being with the well-being of the other person. So it's a balancing act that requires constant vigilance and work. But I have to say, after 36 years, we're still happily married, and in some regards, our marriage is like wine. It gets better with age. So what can I say? I just love working with her.
Well, I tell you, the two of you do complement each other, especially with your description at the front end of your answer to the question, because if I'm correct, you said that you wanted to work towards curing some of these issues, and she wanted to deal with the counseling aspect. And the first thought that came to my mind after you said that was, well, gee, if she's counseling, then she could give you insights into where these people are, what they're experiencing, and so forth, that would then give you support and information as to how to help these people and help others in terms of the prevention aspect. So it just seemed to me like hand in glove. That's you guys were a match made in heaven, as it were.
Absolutely. You know, it's not one or the other. Some people require counseling and therapy to overcome some of their challenges. But for many people, the best thing you can do is to find ways through their parenting, through workplace, through schools, is to disseminate practices that make people strong and resilient. People who have great mental health and who experience high levels of well-being, these are people who weren't just born like that, but they received a supportive education, a lot of love and nurturance from their parents, their teachers. These are people who had opportunities, as I described with our son, to develop their strengths and to live in communities where there is not just wellness, but also fairness. So the more you grow up in a community where people support your physical development, your intellectual development, your occupational opportunities, the more fairness there is in the community, so people are not shut out of the system because they have a disability or because they don't speak with correct accent, quote-unquote. The more fairness there is, the more people flourish. So we really should strive to create communities where we pay a lot of attention to both wellness and fairness. They are both equally important. So I am engaged in community psychology, so I try to promote wellness and fairness at the community level in organizations, schools, and my wife had a ton of experience doing that with individuals and families through counseling. Aura also has a disability, which gives us a unique perspective on life. She uses a wheelchair, she has a mobility impairment. And so Aura has had incredible insights into the lives of people who experience a particular challenge, which only enriches our writing and our collaboration. So I think we both bring different sets of skills and life experiences that hopefully they would be reflected in the richness in the books, in the work we do together.
Well, I would say that you do definitely complement each other as, from your respective backgrounds and education and so forth. And the other aspect of it, too, is that I don't know that I would be quite so self-deprecating myself, Professor, from the standpoint of your appearance and so forth. My personal belief has been for years, because I've looked at couples and wondered sometimes, what in the world is she doing with him, or vice versa? What is he doing with her? And this is based upon just appearance. But that there's always someone out there for someone else. There's always a pairing, a potential pairing, for a lot of different reasons. And I've always thought about that myself. I mean, I would look in the mirror sometimes going, what am I doing with this person? I don't belong here, you know? And yet, guess where I'm at? I'm here. And I am grateful and joyful over the fact that even my present wife chose me. My first wife never saw me because she was totally blind. And I remember the first time she asked me if she could touch my face. So at least she'd have some kind of an indication. And I had no problem there. Go right ahead, you know. It was a very interesting experience. But I've often believed that somehow the heart knows that connection, and it transcends. It doesn't ignore or blind one. It's not like they talk about that, blind love, you know.
Yeah.
I think it transcends the characteristics that are out there. So I just really think that the two of you are perfectly matched, and I think it's very exciting, especially considering the fact that you've brought children into this world who you're going to share through them, in what you've taught them. And I'm curious about that as well, in terms of, you said you have a son.
Yes, we do.
What about his upbringing, not so much educationally through the 6 or 12 or 14 or 18 years of schooling, but in terms of his upbringing with you and your wife, and these concepts that you now elucidate in the Laughing Trilogy, talk to me about that kind of an influence, and what have you seen in regards to those elements that you and your wife have within you that you're now sharing with us, how your son has absorbed that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I strongly believe in deliberate parenting. You know, parenting that is guided by a strong set of values. Principled parenting. You know, not parenting by default, but parenting by design. And I'll give you one example. My wife and I, before our son was born, Matan, that's his name, M-A-T-A-N, Matan, which means gift in Hebrew. Before Matan was born, we decided that we would never use physical punishment. That was a principal decision. We're both psychologists. God knows we saw the ill effects of physical abuse. And we also know that sometimes once you start spanking, it's hard to stop. So we just made the decision we will never use physical punishment. And we were very proud of this decision. It wasn't easy always to go against the grain. For example, in our house, we didn't buy toy guns. There were no toy guns in our house. We also didn't allow watching violent TV programs, and that really broke our hearts. I remember one day when Matan was in elementary school, he complained that he didn't know how to play Ninja Turtles, that the other kids knew how to play Ninja Turtles, and he didn't because we didn't approve so much of the violence in the program. So it wasn't easy, but I think Matan is very resilient, and he's an incredibly happy, productive individual. He's a great husband. He's a great mentor. He's a great chess coach. So I have to give him a lot of credit for growing up in a family with sometimes strict rules. So I think it all starts with deliberate, with what I call parenting by design. Not really just giving in to your instincts or what you think is right, but being very collaborative with your spouse and being very thoughtful. And truth be known, my wife and I know a lot about how to raise kids. We both have doctorates in psychology, and we work with families and kids, and skills, there is no substitute for knowledge and skills, right? So that happened to be our field, and I'm very proud that we raised an outstanding member of the community, a guy who's very happy, passionate about life, passionate about his family, his wife, his dog, his students. He takes great pride in the achievements of his students. So my advice is really twofold. Have a well-thought-out set of principles and values that you stick by, and acquire good information about what is sound parenting. No substitute for the values you want to implement, disseminate in your family. No substitute for knowing some parenting, some child development skills. What is it that kids require at different times in their lives? And I would say the third important pillar of parenting is always, always letting your kids know that no matter what they're going through, you are always there for them. And, you know, through adolescence, we've had challenging times. Every parent goes through difficult times with their kids. And sometimes if your kids don't communicate, don't talk to you much, I think it's incredibly important to always, always convey the feeling that no matter what they're going through, it's always safe to talk to your parents. And it's always safe because you're not going to judge them, you're going to listen to them. And I guess that's one of the most rewarding things in life, is that when your kids grow up, and then they have a challenge or they need to make an important decision, they pick up the phone and they call you to consult. And if they do that, it means you've done a good job. That they don't feel defensive, or that they don't have doubts about just calling and seeking your opinion. So that's one of the most rewarding things, that as you raise your kids, there are many challenging times. And you always have to remember as a parent, my most important message to my kid is, it's always safe to talk to us, and we will always be here to support you. People, not everyone has this privilege or this opportunity to have a family where they can go back and say, I'm having a hard time, or I want to share an accomplishment. It's always, always, you know, Cicero used to say that friendship is great because it halves the pain and it doubles the joy, right? When you have good friends, good supportive family members, and you are sharing something painful, you know, the pain is half when you share it with somebody you love, and the joy is doubled when you share with somebody who supports you. So that's what I have to say about parenting.
Well, I can tell you that I have had that experience as a child of parents who have been there for me. I didn't grow up in necessarily a Norman Rockwell household, although it was pretty darn close. Did not have those dysfunctional Thanksgiving or Christmas dinners that you see on movies and television. And am very grateful for the upbringing that I had. And I did in my first marriage, as well as my second. I did go to my parents. I figured, my goodness, now my parents are now celebrating. They just celebrated their 63rd wedding anniversary.
Amazing.
My father will be 88 in August, and my mother 85, I believe it is, in September of 2019.
Beautiful.
And I've gone to them when we had challenges in both my first and here in my second marriage. Because I figured, my God, look how long they've been married. And, of course, at that time, it was probably closer to 45 or 50 years. They have the experience. Why wouldn't I go to someone who has had these experiences for some kind of support, or at the very least, the moral support, if not literal, here's a check for, or here, borrow this, or do this or that or the other in a material way. At least they're there to say, hey, it's okay. You're going to get through this, and, you know, and so on and so forth. And I think that a lot of people, they, even if they have a good relationship with their parents, their pride gets in their way thinking, no, I have to do this on my own. Well, you didn't get you didn't get where you are on your own. You didn't even get into this life on your own. So, and that's what we're here to do. And that's why you and your wife, not only having your son, but also in creating these other children, we will call books, as well as your lectures and all of the other things available on your website. That's part of that legacy that you will leave with the rest of us as far as helping us to make this a better world. Hopefully for generations to come. There's a lot of pessimism out there. I would assume that based upon this trilogy, you and your wife, and even your son for that matter, you have a great deal of optimism for the future of our civilizations, because it is multiple, and or societies, if you will, and what have you.
Yes, and I have to say, the best way to become an optimist is to do something positive. You know, I think optimism derives from action more than from thoughts or feelings. So I think the more we engage in productive, meaningful activity, it can be within our family, at work, teaching, volunteering, whatever occupation you choose, on a volunteer or on a paid basis, there are so many ways to contribute to the community. That's what gives you optimism, because you are adding value to other people, and hopefully other people will be recognizing and appreciating you for what you're doing. So it's a virtuous cycle. You add value to others, you help, you make a contribution. Hopefully you feel good about what you've done, and that reinforces you to continue doing something good. So I think for everyone out there who's thinking, how can I become more of an optimist, I think is find something that gives you meaning in life, that you enjoy, and do more of it. I think doing leads to optimism more than any kind of, generic predisposition.
Now, forgive me for going back, but I want to get back to one other thing you mentioned regarding parenting. You said that both you and your wife, you have this wonderful education in regards to parenting, at the same time, of course, using that. And I'm wondering, how well did all of that information that the two of you had gathered over the years about parenting, how well did that facilitate? I mean, it sort of answered the question in this respect, but how well did that mesh with the real life experience of raising a child? Did it all come together, or were there situations where you had to make it up because you didn't have that piece of information? They didn't tell us that this was going to happen.
Right. Look, there is always unexpected particular event. You know, each child is a world unto him or herself. Not every child is described in the books, however many parenting books there are. But there are certain principles that if you follow them, you can figure out how to solve a particular challenge. So, look, there is, like in everything, there is good advice and poor advice.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be a discerning customer, and there are a lot of people who pretend to be experts on many things, and they are not. So, really, a good rule to follow for your listeners is to see if the people who are writing these books, whether they are professionals, whether they have published in the scientific literature, whether their work has been subjected to peer review, or whether it's somebody who just woke up one morning and say, now I'm an expert on X, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there is no substitute for education and training and research and scientific preparation. And if you immerse yourself in a particular literature, then you're able to solve most problems if you're a good student. But like everything else in life, parenting requires time, thought, and training.
Mm.
You know, none of us is born a good parent. We require time, thought, and training.
Mm.
And the more we do of this, the better prepared we're going to be.
For those who are just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Isaac Prelatinsky, and I want to ask you to address one of the things that obviously is all about the Laughing Trilogy. The Laughing Guide, I should say, trilogy. The Laughing Guide trilogy. Why laughter? Why? I've been through many different programs where they encourage you to beat on pillows or to scream or, you know, do some other form of releasing and getting through some of the stuff. What is it that laughter does?
Well, that's a very good question. So there has been quite a bit of research on humor, and actually laughter, the act of laughing, is the active ingredient in fun. And it has been found that laughing reduces pain, it helps the immune system, it buffers against stress, it helps overcome negative mood, it prevents burnout, it prevents stress from becoming depression. And most importantly, it increases well-being and positive emotions. And as I said at the beginning of the program, positive emotions create what's called the broaden and build effect, which is you broaden your horizons, you build more resources, more intellectual resources, you are able to see connections among different things. In a way, you can say that you become smarter through laughter. So that's one of the mottos of our books. We say happier, healthier, and smarter through laughter. So there are a few examples of that. People go to thelaughingguide.com, thelaughingguide.com, they can read a little bit about each one of the books. And as I said, we try to make people smarter through laughter. So there is no question that people are drawn to laughing because it has very many healthy effects. There are some negative effects always when we laugh at somebody. Humor can be toxic as well, but for those of us who embrace the healthy side of humor, we just think that humor is a wonderful way to introduce serious topics in ways that are engaging. So this is why each book contains the laughing side and the learning side. In other words, laughing is a resource. It's an untapped resource. In the books, we use them to learn important skills about our personal, psychological, physical, interpersonal, and occupational well-being. Mm.
Well, I am a big advocate of laughter. I would much rather watch the cartoons that I watch, or the funny movies, you know, the comedies, go to comedy plays, that kind of thing, than I would sit and watching horror and high-end drama programs. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of horror films. I've not seen the last real horror film that I saw was probably back in the mid-80s. I was curious. I had never seen the film before, and so my wife and I, we pulled it up on, I forget where it was. Anyway, and we watched The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, my goodness.
And one of the experiences that I vividly remember was that it took like 5 or 10 minutes for us to turn it off because it was so mesmerizing as well as horrific. And maybe that was the reason why. And it's like, why am I filling my head with this stuff? You know, and yet people talk about how, oh, I love being scared and so forth. And I'm thinking, really? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's got their own likes and dislikes, but it's not for me. So I'd rather sit and laugh with you, doctor, than sit and be scared and shivering in the cold somewhere, wondering if the world was coming to an end.
I agree with you. Absolutely.
Dr. Isaac Prilatensky, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program. And should you ever find yourself out here on the West Coast here in Santa Barbara, maybe on vacation or you're giving a speaking engagement, mm-hmm. we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation because there is so much more that you are doing and so much more work that you're involved in, you and your wife and the organizations you're involved with. And we'd love to continue that conversation.
That would be awesome. I will be happy to do so. So thank you so much for the opportunity today.
You're welcome. I also want to ask you 3 final questions before we go that I ask all of my guests. But I want to remind our listeners that if you're listening to the radio broadcast, you better go to the podcast because there is more that we discuss in the program. So be sure to listen to the podcast at SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, etc. And we encourage you to do that. And if you'd like to support this program, PayPal and Patreon accounts on the missions page as well as the homepage of Tell Me Your Story and RichardDugan.com. First of the 3 questions, Doctor, is who is Isaac Prilatensky?
An aging, self-deprecating, very physically active, loving husband and father.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
That people, families, workplaces, and communities will devote their time and their efforts to promoting cultures of wellness and fairness.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
To create a world where everyone feels like they matter, that they feel valued and add value, regardless of their unique situation in life. We should really aim to make sure that everybody matters, that everybody feels valued and adds value.
Well, Doctor, I thank you again for joining us here on the program, Dr. Isaac Prilatensky. Also, that website, once again, for people to go to and find out more about the Laughing Guide Trilogy.
Yeah, people can go to thelaughingguide.com. That's where there is a brief description of the various books and some reviews, thelaughingguide.com. And if people are interested in my blogs and my academic work, they can go to professorisaac.com. Professorisaac.com.
And we encourage folks to go there, and we will tell you right now as soon as I can. There we go. I want to tell you that it is spelled basically, it's obviously the word professor, and then ISAAC. professorisaac.com, professorisaac.com. And again, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you for joining us here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.